Earlier this week, the government announced a 50-cent increase to the minimum wage, taking it to $15.25. And New Zealand's living wage movement announced its new hourly rate was $19.80. Internationally, there's been an ongoing debate about the impact of minimum wages on employment levels. Germany only introduced a minimum wage last year, and there were predictions it would lead to hundreds of thousands of job losses. It hasn't, but then their minimum wage is fairly modest at €8.50 or $13.80 New Zealand. So how high is too high when it comes to setting a minimum wage? And I want your views on this too, because it affects a lot of people in New Zealand. Sunday at rnz.co.nz, you can text 2101. With me now to discuss the issue, Laila Hare, former Associate Minister of Labour and Commerce and now co-owner of living wage employer Ika Seafood Bar and Grill. Laila, hello to you.
Good morning.
University of Auckland Professor of Economics, Tim Hazelden. Tim, hello.
Good morning, Wallace.
And also Economist and Director of the New Zealand Initiative, Eric Crampton. Eric, welcome to the show.
Morning.
Laila, you first. Hospitality, along with cleaning, is an industry with a large number of minimum wage workers. Living wage campaign announced an increase from $19.25 to $19.80 an hour. That was in July. So that is what you pay your staff right now.
Yes, so we became an accredited living wage employer last month, which means that all our staff are paid at least the living wage of $19.25 an hour, and their wages will go up to at least $19.80 by the 1st of July. It's a decision we made because we see our role in business as to provide not just a great service to our customers and to the wider community, but also to run a viable business. And to us, business viability means that the people working in the enterprise are not paid poverty wages and are in a position to have a reasonable lifestyle on the money they earn from the work they do.
What difference has it made to your workers?
It's made a significant difference. I mean, three of our staff, just in the time since they have moved on to the living wage, have been able to get medical treatment that they would otherwise have put off of one sort or another. This is really about making ends meet for the basics of life. It's not a luxury life for those who have a little bit more independence, for instance, are still living at home, are students. It means that they can do some other stuff socially and are able to think about how to reduce their dependence on a student loan.
Tim, do you know where New Zealand sits with regard to minimum wage in terms of other OECD countries? I mean, you heard of Germany there. They've increased their minimum wage to $13.80. New Zealand equivalent.
Yeah, Wallace, and hi everyone. Hi Eric.
Morning.
I don't know every country. I think we're depending on the exchange rate, we're a bit higher perhaps than the United States of America, which has not done much with its minimum wage for some years now, really. So I also think we actually, our minimum wage compared to some other countries is possibly a higher proportion of the average wage or perhaps the living wage. Our minimum wages, but that may reflect how low our average wages are.
Well, is the evidence then to Eric and to you, Tim, Eric maybe, is the evidence that increasing the minimum wage will result in layoffs?
Well, the Department of Labor keeps trying to schedule hikes that they expect won't have particularly large effects on employment. They'll always end up missing the marginally attached workers or some of the part-timers who get knocked out. Tim's right that the minimum wage here is very high as a proportion of the median wage. The last time I checked it was the highest in the OECD relative to the median wage. And that's the right way to benchmark things, right? Because if you're trying to see how binding it's going to be or how many workers are affected by a minimum wage increase, that's really going to depend more on what overall wages look like than on the current exchange rate to the euro or to the US dollar. So the right comparison is the fraction to the median, and we're very high there.
What do you think about the $15.25? Do you think that we can afford it?
I don't think that there is any problem that is solved by the minimum wage that is not better solved through things like wage subsidies and working for families. The minimum wage is very badly targeted. There are lots of people who work on the minimum wage who are in upper decile families, and that's anomalous in New Zealand compared to other places. It'll be partially a result of our having a very high minimum wage relative to the median, but when Treasury had looked at it, something like 60% of minimum wage workers were in the top six deciles.
Well, Tim, what do you make of that?
Oh, that's a question, Eric, if I may. You're the incentives expert amongst us. Do you think working for families encourages people to have babies?
That's an interesting one. You'd think that there should be natality effects of it because you've got... That's something that I've wished somebody would study, and I've not seen data on it yet. You'd think that there should be, and I've not seen results yet.
And you think that there should be an effect for the same sort of reasons of a minimum wage on employment?
I think it'd be because the payments are scheduled to family size, so you should expect some effect there. I'm not sure it'd be that big an effect, but...
The minimum wage,
I was talking about working for families because it's keyed there to the number of kids in the family.
Okay.
So if you want to target working families that have kids, working for families does better. If you're more interested in the wages of college students who have a part-time job on the side while they're studying, and you're not too worried about the ones that get knocked out of work because of it, then maybe you could look at the minimum wage.
Well, you just quoted a figure that a high proportion of people on the minimum wage are in so-called high decile groups, and then used the top six deciles as your definition of high decile groups. That is a significant, that's 60% of the New Zealand working population. And the issue here, I think, really fundamentally comes down to the values you apply to the way that you want to organise work and want to organise income from work. If people go to work, one should expect to earn a living from that job. The argument seems to be that we have a fixed amount of money to go around people who are in certain sectors of the economy that are characterised by low wages, and that those people need to share that pool between them, rather than to say, well, what about those in higher decile groups who are also working in those enterprises, and where there could be some pre-distribution of the wealth of that enterprise to those at the lower pay levels of the enterprise. And I think a really good example of that is in large organisations like government, like city councils, where there is a very wide distribution of wages, and there is no technical reason at all why that wage, the amount available for wages and salaries in those organisations couldn't be better distributed.
That's the key point, isn't it, Eric? I mean, there should be a minimum. There's an expectation that an income, you should be able to live on your income and afford your living expenses out of that income without having to resort to subsidies like working for families. That should be a minimum expectation of a civil society.
I'm going to disagree entirely here. The minimum wage is something different from that entirely. What we should look at is where the burden of supporting lower productivity or lower income workers should fall. Should it fall on the employers and customers of firms that supply goods and services that are produced by lower income workers, or should it fall on the tax base more broadly? We've got a tax system that's progressive, that tries to spread the burden to where it can be afforded. When we instead put that burden onto employers of lower productivity workers, we knock them out of work.
It should fall on the employers.
Well,
that's where it falls, Tim.
Well, I've got a much less mechanistic view of the economy than you have, perhaps, Eric. And I also have a great deal of respect for the ingenuity of people, including especially employers, to adjust to things. I think I agree with Lyle. I think it's a social, it's a cultural, social issue that I think New Zealanders would like to feel that people shouldn't, at least adults, shouldn't have to go to work, shouldn't go to work and not receive, I'd say, a living wage eventually. And I think the economy can adjust to that.
But that keeps kids from ever getting a first rung on the ladder, right? You can't start climbing up to higher levels of experience if you can't get in an entry-level position.
Yeah, I probably agree with you and might disagree with Lila on this. I think it should be for adults, and I think there should be a ladder. Yeah,
well, that's a good point, Lila, because if you pay a 16-year-old what what you're going to pay at ICA Seafood Bar and Grill, a 16-year-old would be on $42,000 a year.
Well, there seems to be a total contradiction, really, in what's being said here, because on one hand, we're saying, Eric's saying that, you know, major beneficiaries of increases in the living wage come from relatively wealthy families. And we know that people from relatively wealthy families are much more likely to have a tertiary education. He talks about college students are going to go on to higher paid employment. And yet we have to protect their right to a low paid job during that period. Why? I think that we should be far more concerned with protecting the right of everybody to earn a livable amount from the jobs that they do, whatever their age and stage of life. And if that means at some point that a college student will miss out on a minimum wage job for a period of time, that's a cost that I think, or an effect that we should be prepared to face in order that a 55-year-old caregiver of elderly people is actually paid more than $15.25 an hour for the work that she does in an essential trade. And who's to define what is a low-value job?
That's a good point, Eric.
Well, when we look at the effects of minimum wages, it's not so much there are some hitting of part-time work by university students, but employers are a little bit more comfortable with those. Where we see the bigger effects, if we look at some work by Gail Pacheco, Maori youth hours worked dropped by about 7 hours per week after the minimum wage was hiked on youth. A 10% increase in the minimum wage in her analysis was where it's binding was reducing employment propensity by about 15 percentage points, and on average in that group by about 4 hours a week. So the negative effects are concentrated in the group you want to help most, Lila.
Except
if we instead help them through wage subsidies, we don't kick them out of work.
What you're not referring to is the evidence that it is not the job that has been lost in those situations. The hours have been reduced for an equivalent income from a higher minimum wage. And in fact, you know, the studies have shown very clearly that that it is not a job loss. There is some reduction in hours, which implies an increase in productivity. So the individual worker is taking home the same or more for working fewer hours, which is a desirable outcome from an increase in the minimum wage.
I want to bring in, and Tim, you may sort of point to this as well. I was actually reading something quite interesting. Lila, you might have views on this. One living wage employer overseas said that things like absenteeism, staff turnover has really declined because workers felt they had more of a stake in the business, and workers themselves were pointing the boss to small inefficiencies, systems that might result in better turnover. Tim, so maybe that's a factor that in terms of Eric's stats has not been factored in.
That's right. This view that a worker's productivity is sort of some fixed number depending on how done they are or not done is wrong. A work is a social act, and as you say, when people get paid more, they feel better about their jobs, they're less likely to leave and create the cost of turnover, they're less likely to steal from their employer because they're frightened of being fired from this good job, and they just work better.
Sure, and employers already know this, right? So they can hike wages if they think that they're going to get better results from it.
Fair enough, Eric, but look, it's this way it's happened. This, say the minimum wage, we haven't got a living wage, but it's gone up for everybody, so no one has to negotiate or worry about it. They're not suffering a disadvantage relative to other employers. They can just get on with the job, and maybe their employees will get on with their jobs a bit more happily and efficiently.
Might be worth looking too at some of Treasury's critique of how that number was constructed.
I've got another point here, and feedback is already rolling through, so keep that coming. Sunday at rnz.co.nz. Pop it up on Twitter at rnzsunday. Lila Hare, Tim Hazeldean, Eric Crampton. David Seymour, he says, and this is fair point, Lila, is that those employers, the regional employers will be hit hard as well. Okay, for you, you're central, you're Auckland CBD, your restaurant, but $15.25 might sound like a lot here, but small businesses that charge less in the regions, you might see more layoffs, more businesses that can't take this. Say the Hawke's Bay, where $15.25, some businesses can't take that type of wage, Lila.
Well, might. It's all not very helpful to coming up with a view or a vision of a good society, a flourishing society. In a flourishing society, people have enough income in order to have a good life. And you know, in, if we look at regional employment, for instance, we have some extreme exploitation of people within our regions and in many of the industries, in particularly the agricultural and horticultural sector. And we have many non-viable businesses keeping themselves viable by surviving on these incredibly low rates of pay, often extraordinarily dangerous working conditions, and we've seen the toll of that in forestry and so on.
Can you relate to, is the Hawke's Bay Chamber of Commerce CEO said he knows employers who hardly sleep on a Wednesday night for fear of the payroll not going through. I take your point, but can you understand that from a small business owner's perspective?
I absolutely understand it as somebody who, you know, manages my own payroll and is very aware of the, you know, tiny margins that we work on in order to manage a viable business. As a society as a whole, we have to look at how we organise work, how we organise the distribution of goods and services in a way that does not create that pressure. And if that means fundamentally re-looking at some of the things we do and some of the ways we share around what is available to us from work, then I think we should be up for that. For example, if it means in aged care that you cannot sustain businesses with high profits and you need to go to a more cooperative model of employment where people can distribute what's available there in a much flatter and much fairer way, but everyone is on a good living minimum, then let's be prepared to look at the structure of that work, the way we organise our enterprises without depending on these sort of precarious ways of organising key services in a way that results in stress for so-called business owners, right, as well as for the workers that they employ.
So if the minimum wage hike wound up knocking a bunch of firms out of existence, that'd be a good thing in your view because they might reemerge as some kind of happy co-ops?
What I believe is that we should be conscious and deliberate about the way that we organise this and not just leave it to the invisible hand of the market to do it for us.
I was saying that wage subsidies are a better way of doing that. That's hardly the invisible hand of the market. That's the government coming in and saying that there are classes of workers who need better support than they can achieve through their own productivity in the market, so they get an additional wage increment from the government.
So that's saying that there are certain people who deserve to have a living income and certain people who don't, and that you will make a set of judgments around
that. No, it's that needs varies across people. Needs vary across people. If you're setting the living wage that you're talking about was already set on a two-parent, two-kid baseline,
well,
right? And not everybody's in that world.
If you can design a state that is able to identify individual needs down to that degree of granularity, then I congratulate you. But actually, what we do it through is a broad set of social and cultural values. And if our social and cultural values are much more oriented around flourishing societies, good lives, equality,
being unemployed,
then we will
is
come
not
up
part
with,
of a good life.
Well, that's right. Absolutely true.
Tim, you okay. come in here.
Okay. Look, if there's one thing that economists really, or orthodox economists really believe must be true, is that the minimum wage reduces employment, increases unemployment. And they've been looking for this effect for a long time, and they are not finding it. I'm aware of Gail's work, and that's interesting, but if you look at the studies, the big econometric studies that go out there looking for this animal in the jungle, they never catch it.
Yeah, that's in the American studies where the minimum wage is about 40% of the median, not in New Zealand where it's 66% of the median. You wouldn't expect like a minimum price for a car of $1,000 to have any effect, but if the minimum price were $25,000, then it would. You've got to look at more studies from countries that have comparably high levels of the minimum wage. Okay. So there's Canadian work showing that hikes in the minimum wage increased poverty because you had people that were knocked out of work whose earnings were critical to keeping families out of poverty.
Let's talk about poverty then, because really income distribution is really the real issue here, I think.
Sure. And if we look at that, we've got more free work.
There's one big country which did not have a major increase in income inequality over the last 20 years, and that's France. And that's been attributed largely to quite large increases in the minimum wages in France. And there may be some employment effects on that, but they cannot be large, or else income inequality would have increased because unemployed people are very poor. So, you know, the economists want to find evidence of what you believe, Eric, but they're not finding it.
This is very interesting. Time has raced by. Just one very, very final comment around the panel. And I want to ask about the living wage, because this has been calculated as the hourly rate required to provide the basic necessities for a family of two adults, two children, 12. With the one adult working 40 hours and one 20 hours a week, living wage. Eric, do you think that we should get to the living wage, just very briefly, sometime in the future?
No, I don't think that you can set a one-size-fits-all minimum wage to try and meet the needs of that kind of defined group for everybody, because you end up knocking the bottom rungs off of the ladder. And at the same time, you can look at how that thing was constructed. They were assuming that nobody who goes shopping, who's poor, ever uses coupons or buys things on special. Okay, it's kind of a nonsense. I use coupons and buy things on special. The living wage assumes that people just go with whatever's on the supermarket shelf.
Have you tried living on $19.80 an hour?
I've lived on less when I was a grad student.
Lila, living wage, is this something that you're going to be sticking with? You think other businesses should follow your model?
I absolutely advocate it, and I would like to be in a society where businesses had that aspiration. But I do think, too, that we've got to start with larger organisations, those who can sustain the living wage by redistributing the existing amount of money that they have to provide for wages and salaries. And that in itself would have a significant impact on equality. If you saw the state sector, the large councils, the large private organisations getting on the living wage bandwagon, I think it would make a real difference.
Tim, a final comment from you?
I think the living wage is a great target for us to have as a people, but I think it'll take a while to get there.
All right. And on this, we have a heavyweight in the food industry from New York City. Her name is Saru Jayamaran. She's talking about tipping and how it's keeping wages down as low as $3 an hour. It is very, very interesting, and it's making a big difference. Eric Crampton, Lila Hare, Tim Hazeldine, thank you very much for being part of Sunday Morning this morning.
You.
Thank you.
Thanks.